mothers taking over the message.
His parting words to me were, "No one will buy this book."
Turning story time into an opportunity to build self-esteem and understanding. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. I was addicted to fairy tales when I was a child. Truth be told, I still love them. But it is a fact that happily ever after endings and princesses waiting to be rescued don't give girls the message that their futures are in their own hands. And if a child has special needs, there's really no one there for them to relate to. This week, we're going to take another look at storytelling and the opportunities it can present to change the message. First, writer Jerry Burns suggests there is a simple, powerful answer for parents.
A friend recently told me that as a kid, he hated reading certain stories because they were about characters he could never be like or look like. You see, my friend has a disability. There can be great ugliness in beauty. I know a mom who struggles with teaching her kids about beauty, wishing for more stories that reflect her kids' Asian heritage. And then there's my friend whose daughter has a rare genetic syndrome. In addition to having a unique appearance, the child uses a wheelchair. There aren't many beloved story characters who conquer kingdoms in assisted devices or who have asymmetrical body shapes. Finding stories that don't marginalize such children can be more challenging than conquering storybook kingdoms. My friends are not alone. Many parents wrestle with this. We comb bookshelves to find stories with illustrations that depict beauty in ways we feel are appropriate for our children. But many images we find are picture book perfect or culturally biased. They don't reflect our reality. So the images become subliminal, insidious reminders of how we should look. Most of us fail. Because pictures send 1,000 messages, some parents carefully screen the images their kids see. They don't want their children receiving messages that might cause them to undervalue their own unique beauty, their own heritage, or their own gifts. They don't want their kids to feel like they don't measure up. They don't want to teach them to aspire to impossible ideals. There can be great ugliness in beauty. Rigorous screening of media is one way to offer images of beauty to kids, but you can also do something else to give children images that reflect them and which build self-esteem. Tell them stories. When you tell a story, every word is chosen by you. Pictures are imagined by the storyteller and the listeners. You define what is beautiful, and you also place beauty in the imagination of the beholder. You can make up a story, adapt a traditional one, or retell one from a book. In so doing, you can define beauty in all the ways that make sense to you. A beautiful character can be from any culture, can have any disability, can mirror any child. Your listeners can imagine themselves riding wheelchairs to glory. Best of all, the potent images of an imagined story can stay with a child for life. Beauty does not equate to blonde hair, white skin, two straight arms, a certain weight range, or a particular ability. Beauty is not just appearance alone. Beauty can be described in all the ways that humans perceive it. Most importantly, when you tell a story, your beautiful characters can have the beautiful traits that your child possesses. Inspire children to find themselves beautiful. Inspire typical children to see beauty in those who have disabilities. Tell them stories. The little girl I mentioned earlier, the one with the genetic syndrome, is one of the most beautiful children I have ever met. Not because she looks like everybody else, but because she looks like herself. Her heart-popping smile is riveting. Her glance has the power to light up the dark. I fall over myself when she smiles at me because her infectious, gorgeous glance kisses my heart. She radiates pure joy. What is more beautiful than that? Every person deserves the chance to feel beautiful. Reclaim beauty for yourself and for the children around you. Beauty does not have to call up the beast of failed hopes. When stories are told personally, when beauty is described consciously, then stories become more beautiful. And that is when they can bring joy, possibility, and peace to parents and children. Beauty does not have to be ugly.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com or visit her at storytellingmatters.wordpress.com. Up next, Amy Fabricant. Her new children's book takes on an issue that is confusing, even for many adults. It's the story of Kayla and her struggle to become her true self. It's called When Kayla Was Kyle. Fabricant said the publisher she was working with told her the book would never sell unless she made all of the characters animals.
I think most people don't understand really what it means to be gender different, and more importantly, how we develop and are hurt by our gender stereotypes. So his parting words to me were, no one will buy this book. And I definitely didn't have a tremendous amount of confidence, even though I had a lot of confidence in the book. Those words, no one will want this book, were still ringing in my head.
And the reason you wrote this book, or at least one of the reasons, was this was your life.
Definitely many parts of the story reflect our experience. I have a gender different child. And when you are raising a gender nonconforming, nonconforming to stereotypes and the world's expectations of what it means, quote unquote, to be a boy, a normal or typical boy, or a normal, typical girl, when you have a child that really expresses their gender outside of that, you get a lot of pushback in reaching out and starting to sort of look out into the world and share some of what we were going through. We found other communities with gender different and gender nonconforming and transgender families and children. And then we began to see some of these experiences were not isolated ones. And so that's the book sort of came out of a couple different families' experiences.
And what is it that you were hoping to get the children and their parents who read this book to get out of the book?
I wanted them really to understand how much power they have in helping another human being, and how to, so that was number one, to understand that language is important, and looking at our own biases and our own sort of belief systems, and how they may be faulty, and how there are other ways to see things so that we might be able to elevate not just that person who's experiencing the difference, but to elevate everybody's experience, to celebrate the diversity, which is what it means to be human.
And I'm assuming when you are dealing with a child who is outside of what's considered mainstream, you're getting into the issues of bullying and self-esteem and feeling isolated with your peers. As a parent, what were you able to do?
It's interesting because I wore, and I still do, many different hats as a parent and as an educator. So I found it really interesting the different things that I tried, and I found that I did not have a lot of success in working directly with parents and making calls and trying to explain, you know, my child may not be, the typical boy, but could we still have a play date? Can we still do these things? Is there something that the kids can connect on? And what I found is that the more and more these differences appeared, there was less understanding, less tolerance, not that anyone wants to be tolerated, but there was less of compassion or heart to say, of course, this is another child, and there's ways that we can connect going beyond what we feel is maybe a little different or uncomfortable to start off with. Wasn't able to do much is what I guess the point was, and that's that there was a lot of sadness and a lot of frustration around that. I wasn't able to make a lot of changes or headway within the schools and as a parent outside of the school.
And how has your story progressed? Where are the two of you now?
We have found very accepting communities. We found school communities. We found social circles. And really, it's turned what's been a terribly difficult struggle into something that's been filled with so much joy. And really, and I'm not saying this to sugarcoat it, but in really feeling so wonderful about being able to celebrate what it means to be human. We don't see people in quite the same way that we used to. And that really goes for all people. And that's how I've come to not only understand gender diversity and sort of the whole LGBTQ experience, which is what I try to do in schools and trainings, but it's how we look at all people. We want to be in a hugely diverse social circle, in all circles, because it's really where we can connect in the deepest of levels and not worry about the things that are just on the outside and all these man-made constructs of labels and categories.
You know, strangely enough, I think one of the hardest things are some of the simplest ones. Now, I do not want to be insensitive, and I do not want to call your child by the gender that your child is not comfortable with, but I don't know what I should say. Is he? Is she? What does she or he prefer?
That is understandable, especially for gender-neutral children and older people that are expressing their gender in ways that we can't clearly define, like you said, male or female. And that's because I think the world, have to sort of catch up with what science is now saying is an actual, it is a thing. Gender diversity exists. Our system, our binary system, sort of either one box or the other, male or female, really doesn't reflect what actually exists. We had a gender different child, and then it was very clear that we had a girl. And so we were able to support that transition. We were able to support her living her life the way it was really completely hardwired and meant to be.
And how old is your daughter now?
16.
And that's a tough age for any child.
It's tougher for the parents.
So do you feel at this point that she's pretty well adjusted and has a good sense of who she is and feels good about herself, or is she still carrying the scars from her childhood?
I think both. I think, what we know about human development is we are resilient, and I think people can heal and go on to live very, very happy, well-adjusted lives. And yet part of the healing process is learning how to look at all the things that were difficult and the scars from growing up. And many of those scars, in our case, and in many other families with gender-different children, many of the scars come from the world's expectations and the world's discriminatory or biases against gender difference. I think that we really need to start very, very early in having these conversations, and I hope families will start, having them too.
Amy Fabricant is the author of When Kayla Was Kyle. You can find out more at whenkaylawaskyle.com. Coming up, reinterpreting a Chinese tradition for new mothers and remembering a woman who was out of this world. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1292. No showering, no going outside, no drinking cold water for an entire month. Many women in mainland China observe these rules as part of a traditional healthcare practice following childbirth called sitting the month. Amanda Ding Yuen Ho spoke to moms in Manhattan and Queens about their own take on this tradition.
Jing Yixu is holding her baby girl, just 33 days old, in her apartment in Morningside Heights in Manhattan. Since giving birth in late September, she has been wearing a hat and scarf every time she goes out. She doesn't drink or touch any cold water. And she eats certain food with almost no salt. This is all part of the traditional Chinese practice of postpartum confinement during the month after childbirth. In Chinese, it's called 坐月子, which literally means sitting the month. I did most of my research online, and it says 42 days for natural birth and 56 days for C-section.
Sitting the month is all about letting the mother restore her health after childbirth. Traditionally, new moms are not allowed to go outside, shower, eat raw food, or drink cold water. But like many educated Chinese women, Xu is adopting a variation on this ancient practice.
I'm not doing it as strictly as how women in southern China or Taiwan do it. Like, you can't bathe or leave the house. But I didn't take a bath or eat ice cream immediately after childbirth, like most of the American moms would do. My approach is pretty moderate.
Xu may have given the practice some modern twists, but she did adopt the diet rules, the cornerstone of sitting the month. Days before the birth, Xu's mother, Ming Tang, flew in from Shanghai to cook for her daughter. Tang obtained an herbal soup recipe in Manhattan's Chinatown and cooked it for Xu every day for the first 2 weeks after she gave birth. The soup, called Shenghua Tang, is very popular in China. Many believe it dissolves blood clots. Xu's mother also cooks soup high in protein and nutrients.
I cook a lot of pig's feet soup, and I also put soybeans in it. It's very rich and can increase her milk supply. I put a pinch of salt in the soup, but she doesn't know. She told me everything has to be cooked bland, but it's difficult for the rest of us to eat.
The practice of 坐月子 dates back 2,000 years in literature, says Zhi Chenzhen, a doctor in Chinese herbal medicine in Manhattan's Chinatown.
When you give birth to the baby, then you become naturally, you become very deficient because you lose a lot of blood, you lose a lot of nutrition. They become very susceptible to any kind of infection because the immune system is really down.
He says sitting the month comes from the traditional Chinese ideology of balancing the energies between yin and yang, hot and cold.
The rule of thumb is that you should avoid exposed to cold thing. Otherwise, you can easily develop the rheumatoid arthritis because when you just give birth to baby, all your joints or pores are open. So the cold air easily invades into your bone, the joint, and the body.
The tradition of sitting the month is deeply embedded in Chinese culture. But immigration to places like the U.S. tests these cultural ties.
Most of it is ridiculous to me. I did my own research. I don't just listen to random people say things.
Adela Chen is originally from southern China. She moved to the United States 12 years ago and gave birth to her baby girl in early September. For her, sitting the month is more like a game of make-believe because she only pretended to be following the rules in front of her mother.
I drank only the hot water in front of her, but I drink anything when she's not around. I did everything that she told me not to do. I ate ice cream. I had sushi. She told me not to eat anything raw or cold because it will give me diarrhea.
Did it?
No.
The way Chen is sitting the month would seem unusual to many Chinese immigrants. But she does believe bed rest is important for recovery, as Western doctors also suggest. Randy Ye is Chinese and also radiology resident at Columbia University. He says the practice is valid from an Eastern medical standpoint, but he wouldn't recommend a complete confinement.
In terms from a purely Western medicine standpoint, sitting the month has no scientifically proven benefit.
He says it's good for the mother bonding with the child, but it can be isolating. Still, he says it shouldn't be discounted simply because it has no foundation in Western medicine.
I would like to say that, you know, you can't really judge a culture for the things that they believe, even though we don't know the reason behind it.
Typically, new moms sit the month at home and receive care from their relatives. But for immigrant women whose families aren't around, many are turning to postpartum centers in the city. These facilities are often operated as home businesses in Flushing, Queens. This is Amanda Ho.
This story is presented in partnership with Open City, an online magazine about Asian immigrant communities in New York City. For more information on this traditional practice and pictures from Amanda Ho's reporting, visit opencitymag.com. And finally, Gilles Malkin is back with another edition of Women in History. This week, he profiles a woman who defied gravity, Sally Ride.
Sally Kristen Ride was born May 26, 1951, in Los Angeles, California. Raised in San Fernando, she first attended Swarthmore, then Stanford University, where she earned a Ph.D. in physics. She was 27 when NASA announced they were recruiting women to take part in the new space shuttle program, and Sally was one of 8,000 who applied. She was accepted, to her amazement, and began her career as an astronaut, by means of which she would become the first American woman in space. Before it was over, her career took her up on the big ride twice, in 1983 and 1984, both times on the Challenger shuttle. She contributed to the design and perfection of the shuttle's robot arm, which is used to deploy new satellites and recapture old ones from their orbits. After the Challenger disaster in 1986, when the shuttle exploded over Cape Canaveral, Sally Ride was appointed to the Investigating Rogers Commission. She was then assigned to NASA's Washington headquarters to serve as a special assistant to the administrator to focus on strategic planning. She became a science fellow at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Arms Control, then professor of physics at San Diego's University of California, and director of the university's California Space Institute, where she developed a field of observing indicators of climate change. But Sally Ride's special legacy was much farther reaching than all of her work in space exploration. She created a company called Sally Ride Science, which was designed to encourage and develop the interest of young people, and notably girls, in the sciences. Today, Sally Ride Science has science camps, a science academy, many projects and affiliations, many publications, texts, and programs to train teachers to fan the spark of interest in their students. Her efforts included a NASA program called EarthCam, an online website where students can take satellite photos of the Earth from space, and Grail MoonCam, which allows photos to be taken of the moon. Ride was married to fellow astronaut Steve Hawley for 5 years. She then found a life partner in Tam O'Shaughnessy, also a co-founder of Sally Ride Science. They collaborated in writing half a dozen books to help lead youngsters into the marvels of scientific education. She was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame, the Astronaut Hall of Fame. She won numerous honors and awards, had a landing site on the moon named after her, and in 2013, posthumously received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I would liken Sally Ride to a human comet, who streaked across the horizons reserved in the past for men only, and left us a trail of light, sparkling with new opportunities, enabling women of the future to access endless possibilities through education in the sciences. Sally Ride died of pancreatic cancer on July 23, 2012, at the age of 61. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.